Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
A very good morning and welcome to Africa Link this Tuesday morning, the 3rd of May. I am Jane Ayeko Kumet in Bonn, Germany. In today's edition, as the world marks Press Freedom Day, we take a look at the state of press freedom in Uganda and elsewhere.
During elections, the Communications Commission closed social media just because they believed it is going to be used against the government.
And politics in the DR Congo are heating up since a coalition of opposition parties has named Moise Katumbi as candidate.
It's actually the second coalition of opposition parties that has come out speaking in favor of former Katanga governor Katumbi to run in the country's next presidential elections.
Those stories and more coming up in the next 25 minutes, so don't go away.
Top story.
Every 3rd of May, journalists the world over celebrate World Press Freedom Day. The day was proclaimed by the UN General Assembly in December 1993. This year's theme is Access to Information and Fundamental Freedoms. This is your right. But unfortunately for many journalists, freedoms merely exist on paper as they are arrested for critical reporting. With this as the underlying focus, what is the state of press freedom in sub-Saharan Africa? I put this question to Kerry Patterson, a research associate with the Committee to Protect Journalists Africa program.
The honest answer to that question is that it varies a lot from country to country. The sort of current state of press freedom in Kenya is very different from the state of press freedom in the DRC than South Africa or Angola or Sierra Leone. So I think, you know, certainly there's always room for improvement, no matter which country we're speaking about.
Media persecution in Africa is often alleged to be carried out by government agencies who, on the other hand, often claim that journalists undermine the law. What's your take on this?
I think that the reality is that we see commonly leaders of various countries, certainly in sub-Saharan Africa, using insult laws or criminal defamation laws as a means of silencing the press on things that they don't want to have said. But the reality is that a robust and free press is essential to a democracy. It's a cornerstone of ensuring that power is held to account and that the truth sort of makes its way to the surface. Governments frequently seem to suggest that journalists are not following the law when actually what they're doing is simply being open and critical in a way that a government doesn't appreciate. And we've seen that time and time again. What is deeply concerning is the number of countries who then try to disguise those crackdowns as security issues. Ethiopia has been a key example of that, of using anti-terrorism laws as a means of silencing critical press or dissenting voices. Journalism is a public service. The government does not have any space to be shutting it down or silencing them just because they don't like what they have to say.
During the last presidential elections in Uganda, government shut down the internet. Similar cases we also witnessed in Chad and Congo Brazzaville. Do you think that the use of internet, especially social media, is becoming a threat to some African politicians?
I think that for as long as there are journalists who are holding politicians to account, there will be politicians trying to silence them. And the reality is that people have a right to information. People have a right to know what's going on. They have a right to the ability to communicate. You know, ultimately, anywhere where people have access to a forum to speak out, to express critical or dissenting opinions, to suggest that they think things could be done differently or better, or to highlight what they see as failings or problematic practices or troubling practices by their governments, governments are going to often see that as a threat.
Like you said, that the state of press freedom in Africa actually differs from one country to another. We know that in some cases there is significant press freedom. But even then, what can be done to improve media freedom in most African countries?
One is repealing draconian criminal defamation laws. There should not be any journalist who faces imprisonment or extreme punishment in criminal defamation cases. Defamation can be a civil suit. It doesn't need to be treated as a criminal cause. Secondly, following up on impunity cases. In countries where journalists are killed, and there are, you know, have been several in Africa, particularly in recent years, people need to be held to justice. We need to see that those cases are followed up on, that there's a robust investigation, that trials are free and fair, and that the people who are responsible for killing journalists are held to account.
I was speaking to Kerry Patterson of the Committee to Protect Journalists Africa program. Now we take a closer look at press freedom in one of East African countries, Uganda. Journalists there face numerous restrictions from the government regarding the way they report. The government has passed several laws restricting journalists and media houses. There have been cases of media houses being closed while several journalists have been arrested. Our correspondent in Kampala, Alex Gita, reports that journalists have become the target of law enforcement agencies.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has warned Ugandans not to participate in any political protests and journalists not to cover such protests. This comes as the leading opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, prepares to hold a series of countrywide demonstrations against Museveni's swearing-in this month. Museveni advised the Ugandan media to concentrate on stories that encourage people to create more wealth than covering political protests. The Ugandan government has arrested TV journalists before after they have reported about demonstrations on site. Robert Sempala is a journalist and an activist with the Human Rights Network for Journalists. He says despite efforts to report crimes committed against journalists, the police has offered little help.
We have seen armed men in uniform, especially the police officers, target journalists at all times. This seems like it is condoned by the leadership of the police because we have lodged so many cases with the Professional Standards Unit of the police, which is a disciplinary body of the police, but not even a single one case has been investigated in over 3 years.
Uganda's government has closed down media houses for what they called unfair reporting. Police stormed the headquarters of the Kampala-based Daily Monitor newspaper and took their computers and kicked journalists out of their offices in July 2015. The police said it was looking for evidence and a source for a story that the government was preparing to rig the 2016 general elections. Radio stations, more especially those based outside the capital, Kampala, have also been closed down for interviewing opposition figures. On election day last February, government closed down all social media sites, including Facebook and Twitter, for what they called security reasons. The executive director of the Uganda Communications Commission, Godfrey Mutabazi, says this will not be the last time unless social media is used responsibly.
Have to be very careful. We want to work together. Social media is a very good invention. It is going to transform this nation. But once it's abused, then you force the government to take drastic measures that will be unpopular.
The sites were closed down to stop people from posting results from their polling stations. Government said no one had the authority to announce results apart from the National Electoral Commission. Analysts believe, however, that the difference in opinion comes from what government views as misuse of social media. Magera Peter is a lawyer and also a programs officer at Human Rights Organization Chapter 4.
If the issue is around what they think is against the government, during elections, the Communications Commission closed social media just because they believed it is going to be used against the government. And you might have situations where they come in and close a radio station because they feel what it's doing is not in line with government. And instead of a commission promoting free media, free speech, it's used as a tool to control it.
The government set up a division within the police to specifically target alleged media offences. Most cases so far handled by this division are cases against social media bloggers, political talk show hosts and producers, and television and radio reporters. The media, with the help of non-governmental organizations, are trying to fight some of the laws they consider oppressive. Some cases have been referred to the East African Court of Justice after they were rejected by the local courts. For instance, journalists in Uganda are not supposed to report on demonstrations before they take place because that is seen as publicizing and inciting the public, according to the Ugandan government. Many media houses, including the New Vision, which is partly owned by the government, have stopped reporting on homosexuality unless they are quoting the president or parliament. And journalists are not supposed to talk to rebels, and those who do are compelled to reveal their source of information. With all these restrictions, the idea of free media remains a myth in Uganda.
Alex Gita in Kampala. Stay tuned for how one man is helping disabled kids in Tanzania.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Germany has recently intensified relations with Africa. Evidently, the German Foreign Minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, has so far visited more than a dozen African countries. This week, he is in West Africa visiting Mali and Niger. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has also been hosting some African presidents, among them Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi. What could be the driving force behind Germany's newfound interest in Africa? I put this question to Professor Robert Kappel of the German Institute of Global and Area Studies, GIGA, in Hamburg.
The German government is very active in Africa. It's not only the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Chancellery, but also the Minister of Economic Cooperation. So the main objective of Germany's policy in Africa is, of course, migration, refugees on the one side, and economic interest in Africa. And additionally, of course, also fight against terrorism. These are the three main objectives of German activities during the last 2 years, let's say.
Mr. Kappel, we also know that you've been very critical of the German-Africa cooperation. Why is it so?
What I see is the activism is great and we improved our Africa policy. But nevertheless, I have some criticism because we not so much deal with the African development perspective because Africa is changing. Many countries have high growth. Some are lagging behind. And so we have a differentiation on the African continent, and we should deal with this differentiation. In my view, we don't have a concept for the middle-income countries and the bigger countries. We have a concept for development cooperation with least development countries, low-income countries, those who are poverty-stricken, but we don't have a concept for middle-income countries, let's say, for instance, for Nigeria or South Africa or Kenya, because they are changing Africa very much.
Robert Kappel of GIGA there.
Africa on the move.
And for our Africa on the Move segment, we visit Mozambique, where locals of Mafalala in the outskirts of the capital Maputo are offering visitors walking tour through their neighborhood. They've been doing this since 2009, aiming at telling people the history of the country to change their perception of Mozambique. The hope is that this will contribute towards a better future for the country. This report by Christiane Viere Tesiere is presented by Wanjiku Mwaura.
Maputo's Mafalala neighborhood experienced some of the worst racial segregation during Portuguese colonial times. But it also has impressive stories to tell about people who turned their difficulties into motivation for the fight for independence. So Ivan Laranjeira and his friends from Ivoca Association want to make the history of Mafalala known to everyone. They offer tourists tours around the area. The tour starts where Maputo's concrete buildings end. There was a demarcation line running straight through the capital with white Europeans living on one side and black Africans on the other, Ivan Laranjeira points out.
And this division that was very conspicuous on terms of infrastructure was also one division that was based on race.
The lives of the Africans were fraught with difficulties. That led some to join the fight for independence, Ivan tells the tourists. But even today, living conditions remain harsh for the 20,000 inhabitants of Mafalala. Who then would have thought that Mozambique's first president, Samora Machel, once had a house in this neighborhood? This was when Samora, who ended up leading the country for 11 years, came to the capital to study. It was also in Mafalala that another former president, Chissano, found his political calling.
Chissano, Samora, como todos os outros, foram capazes.
In the end, Joaquim Chissano, Samora Machel, and so many others won. They represent an ever-burning light at the end of the tunnel.
Uma luz que está sempre acesa, né?
But it's not only politics. Mafalala is also home to various football legends, Ivan Laranjeira tells his visitors. Eusebio, one of the most famous Portuguese players of the 60s, grew up in this part of town. Long before independence in 1975, Mafalala already attracted people from all over Mozambique. Thus, all groups and religions are represented here. There's harmony and tolerance among the inhabitants. One highlight of the Mafalala tour is a performance by women of the traditional Makawan dance group, Tufo. Dressed in colorful outfits, they sing and dance for the visitors. But in spite of the tourists, there is not enough money to improve infrastructure. Although there is no official division anymore between downtown, where the rich and affluent still live, and the periphery, most investments in infrastructure from the boom of the 90s and 2000s tend to scatter the poor suburbs and concentrate on the cement town. Ivan Laranjeira believes this could change if Mafalala is finally recognized as an official historical site. Recently, the Ivoca Association had at least a partial success when Mafalala obtained the title of Maputo Cultural Heritage Site.
Wanjiku Mwaura with a report by Christiane Viere Tessiere. Pressure is mounting on DR Congo's President Joseph Kabila's government to hold polls as planned in November. A coalition of opponents of Kabila have announced former regional governor Moise Katumbi as their joint opposition candidate. Last month, police in the southeast of the country fired tear gas to break up a demonstration of 5,000 people in the latest unrest triggered by fears that Kabila plans to extend his rule into a third term. To understand the politics in the DRC, I've been speaking to Christoph Vogel, a research fellow at the University of Zurich.
This most recent opposition movement that you're referring to, it's actually known under its acronym AR, which means Alternation for the Republic, and has been going on in the past few days. But this only regrouped a number of pretty small opposition parties with some heavyweight politicians that have had very influential positions in the past. But these parties, I think there are about 15 or 16 in total, do not represent a lot of political weight these days. But it's actually the second coalition of opposition parties that has come out speaking in favor of former Katanga governor Katumbi to run in the country's next presidential elections. So there is certainly some momentum of increased support to a possible candidacy of Katumbi. But specifically this most recent coalition, in my view, doesn't add so much weight to another coalition of parties referred to as the G7 that has been coming up with similar proposal already a few weeks ago.
You've just said that Katumbi was a former governor within the government of President Joseph Kabila. What change can we expect him to bring to the people of Congo?
And as Katanga governor, Katumbi was widely praised for leading the province with a very keen sense for business. So there was a comparatively good situation for all sorts of investments, especially in the mining sector. But as such, recently he has left politics for the time being and left also the ruling coalition.
The Electoral Commission has said that it needs more time to prepare for elections, which could imply that elections may not take place in November 2016. Could this postponement trigger violence?
Well, I think it's completely true that many observers and also voices out of the Congolese political scene seem to be more and more convinced that these elections will happen with at least a few months of delay and not before next year. It's very difficult, however, to speculate about whether this will lead immediately to violence or to popular riots. As you've seen in the past in the Congo, open violence on the streets on a large scale through the population has been, let's say, since at least the early 90s, has been a very rare phenomenon.
That put aside, is the DRC politically mature to hold a peaceful vote?
Well, I think from a Western perspective, it's a bit complicated to talk about things like whether or not an African country or a former colony is politically mature, because we tend to have very paternalistic views on these issues, and I don't want to contribute to that. But however, what is clear is that the DRC is definitely approaching a period of high political contestation. According to the current constitution, the incumbent president Kabila is not supposed to run again for presidency, and under this situation, We see definitely an increase in political competition, in particular between the government and the opposition, but also to some extent in between opposition parties which haven't so far agreed on a joint candidate.
Christoph Vogel, a research fellow at the University of Zurich.
Making a difference.
Children with disabilities continue to face discrimination and are often excluded from basic rights such as education. Often, parents are ashamed of their children's disability and hide them away. One man in the Tanzanian town of Arusha tries to change that and now helps hundreds of children. DW's Mabel Gundlach met Loy Yamat, who has taken up the task of teaching mentally and physically disabled children. Her report is now presented by Fred Muvunyi.
Loy Yamat is a teacher in a special class. His students are deaf, so they learn how to pronounce the letter A using sign language. When these children in Iboru near Arusha learn how to say samaki, Swahili for fish, it is all thanks to Loy Yamati's initiative.
I started this program 14 years ago without a classroom and without a teacher. I was teaching deaf and mentally disabled children in a storage room.
A school for disabled children is certainly not a given in Tanzania. Over the years, Yamat raised money for new classrooms. To raise awareness among parents and the community on the special needs of these children, Yamat founded a small non-government organization named Hakrit. The problem is that parents often hide their disabled children out of a sense of shame or a feeling that they must be protected, thus cutting them off from any possibility to take part in social life. Yamat wants to change that.
People with disabilities are faced with a high number of challenges. For a start, concerning education, 90% of children with disabilities in Tanzania are still not sent to school.
Oftentimes, disabled children are also neglected by their own families. Teacher Yamat calls on Jessica Mwakatundu. Her husband left her when it turned out that their son, Gideon, was mentally handicapped. The family also abandoned them. But teacher Loy Yamat has done a lot for Gideon, his mother says.
Sana, mabadiliko ni makubwa sana.
There is a tremendous change. He was not always himself, but after he started going to this school, he slowly started to change.
Pole pole akawa anabadilika.
Yamat wants all his students to learn how to lead an independent life. His students also profit from his teachings. It is not only that they now know how to describe a word like fish in sign language. More importantly, they are developing social skills by being with other children and adults. Some of them, like 15-year-old Mishimu Dadiana, have big plans.
I would like to continue with my education up to secondary school and then on to university.
Loy Yamat does not fault his commitment to his proteges, and he will go on fighting against prejudice and lack of interest.
Fred Muvunyi with a report by Mabel Gundlach. With that, we come to the end of today's program. But before I leave, here is a recap of our main stories. The world marks Press Freedom Day as the situation in sub-Saharan Africa remains dire. And German's Foreign Minister Steinmeier visits Mali and Niger. Remember, we welcome your opinion on this program. Please send us your comment via text message to +491609575910, in an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to AfricaLink DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. Join me, Jane Ayeko-Kumar, tomorrow at the same time. For now, have a wonderful day.